It's October 29, 2009, in Radadesh, Belgium. A reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 25, The Characteristics of King Puranjana, Text 3. Prachinnabharhisham kshata Karmashvasaktamanasam Narado jatma tatfagna Kripalu pratya bodhayat. Please chant. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. While the princes were undergoing severe austerities in the water, their father was performing different types of fruitive activities. At this time, the great saint Narada, master and teacher of all spiritual life, became very compassionate upon the king and decided to instruct him about spiritual life. Where do you see in the Sanskrit that Narada is the master of spiritual life? What's the Sanskrit words? Yes? Louder. Yeah? Come on. Yes, there you go. Tatvagna. He knows the truth. Of course, Krishna also says in Bhagavad Gita, tatva darshinaha, you see the truth. Actually, you know it. It's not just a theoretical construct, but it's something you have realized knowledge of. And here we see karmashu. Prachinnabharhisha was engaged in fruitive activities. Purport. As pointed out by Prabodhananda Sarasvati Thakur, a great devotee of Lord Chaitanya, Kaivalya, or merging into the Brahman effulgence, is just like going to hell. He similarly states that elevation to the upper planetary systems for the enjoyment of heavenly life is just so much phantasmagoria. You know what phantasmagoria is? Do you know what a phantom is? Like a ghost. It's something insubstantial. So phantasmagoria, it has no substance. This means that a devotee does not give any importance to the ultimate goal of the karmis and gyanis. The ultimate goal of the karmis... Why is Prabhupada talking about this? He just likes to talk about gyanis and karmis and how worthless they are. What does this have to do with the verse? He's performing ritualistic ceremonies, and I'm sure he was performing them according to the Vedas. I'm sure he wasn't doing some concocted ritualistic ceremonies or black magic or something. I'm sure he was doing pious Vedic activities. And what did Narada want to do? Put him on the right path. What's the words here used again in Sanskrit for what Narada knows? Tattva. What's tattva mean? Truth. Okay, so this means that a devotee does not give any importance to the ultimate goal of the karmis and gyanis. The ultimate goal of the karmis is, what's their ultimate goal? Sense gratification. Where do you get the best sense gratification? In heaven, not in Belgium. Not even in Hawaii. Okay, right? Everybody thinks Swargalokas in Hawaii. The ultimate goal of the karmis is promotion to the heavenly kingdom, and the ultimate goal of the gyanis is Brahman, merging into the Brahman effulgence. Of course, the gyanis are superior to the karmis, as confirmed by Lord Chaitanya. Koti karmista madje eka gyani shresta. One gyani or impersonalist is better than many thousands of fruitive actors. Chaitanya Charitamrita, Majjhalila 19.147. Where do we find a place where it says that the gyanis are worse than the karmis, O you bhakti shastris? Sri Ishopanishad, yes, one of the astonishing statements of Sri Ishopanishad. And what is that? What does it say? You're close. Anyway, those who are worshiping the so-called absolute are worse than those who are just fruitive actors. So that's, I believe, the only place. And I'd love to be corrected, but I believe that that's the only place where it's reversed, where it says the gyanis are worse than the karmis. Generally, we find the gyanis are superior to the karmis. And here, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is saying, koti karmista, among many thousands of karmis, eka gyani shrestha, one gyani is superior to many thousands of karmis. Therefore, devotee never enters, and why is Prabhupada making the point here that the gyanis are higher than the karmis? There's nothing in this verse about gyanis, so why is he even bringing up gyan? That's certainly one possibility, that frustration with karma might induce you to take up gyan. So it might be related to karma in that way, to show that, because what's Prabhupada's main point here? Narada Muni goes to this king who's engaged in Vedic ritualistic actions to show him the truth. And what's the main point Prabhupada's making here? Yeah? Okay. To show that bhakti, so he's showing bhakti superior by presenting the yoga ladder. You said he's showing bhakti superior by saying that eventually karma will frustrate you and in jnana. Any other reason why he's mentioning jnana here? As a convincer. Okay, how is he using jnana as a convincer that karma is not desirable? There was a progression here. What he started out the purport, very beginning of the purport, by saying that merging into the Brahman effulgence according to Prabodhananda Sarasvati is like, Kaivalya is like hell. Now he's telling us that according to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, one jnani is better than 1,000 karmis. So why is Prabhupada bringing up jnana here in order to say that that bhakti is better than karmi? Gyan goes beyond the moons. Okay. Therefore, it's better than karma. Okay. Other ideas? Definitely closer to Bhagavan. But I think Prabhupada's main point here is saying what's wrong with karma. I think his main point here, because people might ask, why is Narada Muni wanting to disturb this king? He's a pious man. He's following the Vedas. He's not doing anything against the Vedas. Why would Narada Muni want to disturb him? And Prabhupada's here saying how karma is not worth anything. And he's saying that first he's comparing it to jnana. He's saying it's only 1,000th the benefit of jnana. And jnana is like hell. So karmic fruitive activities are worth 1,000th jnana at best, and jnana is also not of interest. So then what is the value of karmic activities? And of course all the other reasons that you said as well. And I'm sure if we discuss this for another hour or two, we could find many, many more reasons why Srila Prabhupada has brought the discussion of jnana into this purport. Therefore, so now Prabhupada's giving, first he gave the premises, now he's giving the conclusion. Therefore, a devotee never enters upon the path of karma or elevation by fruitive activities. Narada Muni took compassion upon King Prachinabharishad when he saw the king engage in fruitive activity. In comparison to mundane workers, now this is interesting, Prabhupada now goes below the king. In comparison to mundane workers, those who are trying to be elevated to the higher planetary systems by performing yajñas are undoubtedly superior. So he's giving a little nod to what the king is doing. He's saying, you know, it's certainly better than just somebody who has no contact with the Vedas, somebody who's not doing anything religious. the ordinary average person in the world today is certainly not in anywhere close to as good of a position as King Prachinibharishad. So if merging into the Brahman is like hell compared to bhakti, merging into the Brahman is pretty nice. Compared to the activities of an ordinary person in this world at present, going out to the bars, watching the football games, merging into the Brahman is incredible. Going to heaven is incredible. Going to Brahman is thousands of times greater. But compared to bhakti, if you're looking down, compared to bhakti, merging into the Brahman is hell. And fruit of activities according to the Vedas is worth a thousandth of that hell. And then the ordinary activities of mundane workers are far inferior to that. Of course, Rupa Goswami in the Upadeshamrita also gives this sort of a progression. In pure devotional service, however, both karma and gyan are considering bewildering features of the illusory energy. So Prabhupada's looking up and down. Right? Looking up, this is the way it's superior, but looking down from bhakti, all of these things are rejected. Prachinabhar hisham kshatta karmasvastakshmanasam narado dhyatma tattva gnan kripalu pratyabodayat. While the princes were undergoing severe austerities in the water, their father was performing different types of fruitive activities. At this time, the great Saint Narada, master and teacher of all spiritual life, became very compassionate upon the king and decided to instruct him about spiritual life. Not too long ago, I was talking with Sri Prahlad. You all know Sri Prahlad? We were talking about modern media, and how basically the media is just full of two things: sex and violence. And he said, yeah, that's karma and gyan. I said, huh? Karma and gyan? He says, yeah, sex is you want to enjoy the world, and gyan, you want to destroy everything. And they want to stop everything. Annihilation. And this is the two main urges of the conditioned soul: to try to enjoy or to try to negate. Right? Either way, by negating, they're also trying to find happiness. And this is, of course, the main two reasons why people take up bhakti also. Artha, artati. Either you want happiness or you want freedom from distress, which are very similar, but they're not exactly the same thing. And then, of course, there's also the curious, and then the rare, rare person who's already Brahman-realized, like Sukadeva Goswami or the Four Kumaras, who want to go further in knowledge. But generally, our motivations are we want happiness, or we want freedom from distress, and maybe mixed with some curiosity. What's going on? Is there a God? Is there a supreme goal of life? And the majority of the religious systems of the world teach that the goal of religion is one of these things. They teach either the goal is to go to heaven and have wonderful enjoyment, or the goal is some sort of salvation or liberation. Isn't it? When my father asked Prabhupada, can I come to the temple even though I have my own religion? And Prabhupada said, what is the meaning of many religions? They have to know where they're going. Many planes can come to Chicago, but they have to know that their goal is Chicago. Otherwise, you can't talk about many planes. And most of the preachers and the teachers in the religious systems today do not teach that bhakti is the goal. A few. There are some exceptions. But generally speaking, they don't. The goal is heavenly enjoyment, or the goal is peace, negation. Now both of these things, both incredible enjoyment and freedom, liberation means freedom, peace, fearlessness, both of these things are natural parts of the soul. We were just reading a verse, where were we? In Budapest, where Prabhupada said, one must come to the platform of fearlessness and joyfulness in order to actually attain bhakti. One must become both fearless and joyful. So these are the two things that people want through gyan and karma. Through karma they want joy, and through gyan they want fearlessness. They want peace. And both of these are natural birthright, as Brahma says, Dayabhag. You inherit something. You inherit it. It belongs to you. It's already yours. We're already Satchit Ananda. We're full of Ananda. We're full of happiness. We're full of Sat and Chit. We're eternal. Na jayato miyate bhakatachit nayam bhutva bhavipava nabhuya ajo nitya shasvato yam purano nahanyate hanyamane shri re. We already have freedom from all suffering. Krishna says the soul can't be hurt by anything. Gives all these lists. Nothing can hurt the soul. We're indestructible. We're not affected by any sort of pain or death. We have full knowledge. We already have these things. Naturally, we want them. Everybody wants to be themselves, right? Isn't that? I mean, isn't that a natural thing? I want to be who I am. I want to be my authentic self. So, of course, we're looking for those things. Looking for joyfulness and fearlessness is not bad. In fact, Prabhupada says it's required. You cannot advance. So this is the Brahma-Bhuta platform. Naso-chatina-kansati-sama-sarveshu-bhuteshu. Prasanatma. Great joyfulness. And how much opulence and joy. I mean, if we think about the heavenly planets, I was just reading this morning about Krishna erecting the Dwarka fort and the opulence of Dwarka. The opulence of Dwarka. That the floors are covered with valuable jewels. There's gold water pots in every room. You know, I have a water pot in my room, but it's just plastic. Could you imagine we give each devotee a gold water pot? Jewel-encrusted room. You know, we're lucky just if we can put a little gold leaf on the plaster carvings. And whose palace is the most opulent in Dwarka, do you know? Who has the most opulent palace? Hmm? No. No. It's not any of Krishna's palaces. She's not in Dwarka. Ugrasena! The most opulent palace is given not to Krishna, to a devotee. Wow. Huh? And we left this person. We left this person who gives the greater opulence to the devotees. As Prabhupada was talking about, when Krishna goes with the cowherd boys, he has samosas and kachoris, and the cowherd boys just have japatis and dal, and Krishna eats their japatis and dal and gives them the samosas. Krishna's giving pleasure to his devotees in the spiritual world. It cannot be compared even to Brahman, what to speak of to Swarga. And peace and freedom? It's explained that the residents of the spiritual world can do whatever they want. They only have to follow two rules, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says in Bhakti Loka under Niyamagraha. They have to love and not envy, that's all. As long as you love and don't envy, you can do whatever you want. You have kalpavriksha trees. You can go any planet, Prabhupada explains in the first canto. I mean, here it's difficult even to go from, you know, one country to another. What are you doing here? Even when I go back to America, what are you doing here? How long are you going to stay here? Thinking, I'm an American. But there you can go, wherever you want, any planet. You can have whatever form you want, anything you want. So full freedom, full peace. All the benefits one looks for in salvation, all the benefits one looks for in karma, they're all there. And not only are they all there, but like any loving parent wants to share their opulence with their children. Right? Parents like to give to their children. It's their pleasure. They want to see their children exceed them even. This is just normal. And we even feel this way about our friends, don't we? Don't you like giving things to your friends? Isn't that pleasurable? Krishna's not stingy or envious or a miser. we are the fool. It's completely 100% us. That we say, no, I want to get enjoyment and freedom in another way, separate from you. Somebody says, okay. You know, that's not possible, but you can imagine. Because everything we're trying to use to get enjoyment and freedom is nothing but Krishna. Mayatatamidam sarvam jagadav yakti murtina. It's all Krishna. Bhumirapanalova, earth, water, fire, air, ether. It's all Krishna. How we're not getting any enjoyment separate from Krishna. We're not getting any freedom. So you merge into the Brahman, that's also Krishna. Krishna tells Arjuna, this effulgent is my very self. Brahmeti, Paramatmeti, Bhagavaniti, Sabyate. It's all Krishna. But what's wrong is the mentality. What's wrong is I'm thinking, you know, it's probably saying the ordinary fruit of workers, they're just trying to steal from Krishna. Imagine the son goes into the father's house. The father's willing to give, and the son takes a gun. Give me your money. He says, you don't need to use a gun. I'll happily give you my money. Why are you coming with a gun? So that the lowest of the materialistic persons, the Vikarmis, they're trying to steal. And okay, if you go to your father's house with a gun, then you may have to go to jail. Even though your father's willing, it's no need. And then the next level, the Karmis, they want to make a deal with their father. They're not really interested in the father. They're interested just, you know, the person with the gun. They don't care about the father. They care about the father's opulence only. And the next level also, all they care about is the father's opulence. Okay, I'll do this and this for you as long as you give me money, you give me a place to stay. It's just a business deal. Actually, when Krishna leaves the rasa dance and returns, and the gopis ask about the different kinds of lovers, and Krishna says that those who are merchants are the worst. So I'm just doing a business deal. So the karmis are trying to do a business deal. Okay, let's see. I do this ritual, that ritual, this ritual. That. They're trying to use Krishna like an ATM machine. You know, I punch in. And so we do this, we carry this mentality because this is the mentality with which we originally come to Krishna. You know, we still carry this mentality often for quite some time. You know, if I just chant so many rounds of japa and I just wave so many sticks of incense and read so many books, and as Dhananjaya was telling us yesterday, if I just memorize the whole Bhagavad Gita, then, you know, Krishna's going to have to give me what I want. And he doesn't really respond very well to that. I mean, none of us would. Would any of you respond to that? You know, if the husband comes home and says, okay, brought you 2 dozen roses, diamond bracelet, make my favorite food. He said, wait, what is this anyway? What kind of a relationship do we have? So that's the position of the karmis. And then again, what are they enjoying? It's all on a false platform. And the gyanis also, they're trying to force freedom. I'm just going to stop all of my senses, stop my existence. It's all on the platform of force. Therefore, what they achieve is not satisfying. It's a reflection, as Krishna says, the reflection that appears to be in darkness. Just like I can see both a clock and a reflection of a clock in that mirror. So if I try to get the clock and the reflection, I'll just hurt my hand. I have to turn around. So when we turned our faces from Krishna, all we see is a reflection. Real enjoyment and real freedom, ironically, come from one who's not interested anymore in enjoyment and freedom. That's what Jesus said. He said, those who try to find their lives will lose it, and those who lose their lives for my sake will find it. Just like if things are in the reflection, it appears that by putting my hand in front of me, I will get them. But actually, I have to turn around It's behind me. So these things are very counterintuitive to the conditioned soul. Real enjoyment and real freedom to an unlimited degree. Practically speaking, the devotees enjoy on an equal level with God, sometimes greater than God. Ugrasena's palace is the most beautiful, sometimes greater than God. Krishna's feeding the cowherd boys more palatable food than he's eating. So to have that kind of enjoyment, unlimited enjoyment, Krishna gives the devotees in Vaikuntha forms like his. So non-envious. Who of us would want everyone to have equal or greater opulence to ourselves? Would you like everybody to be as smart and as beautiful and as wealthy or whatever as you are? Not likely. And so much freedom. But the devotees don't care for that. They just care for Krishna. I mean, again, just think in relation to ourselves. If somebody is having a relationship with you because they want something from you, not because they care about you, you might give them something, but you're not really going to give them everything. And if they just care about you, then whatever you have to share, you're going to share. Just naturally. So bhakti means I've lost interest in my own happiness and freedom. Not by repressing them. Not by repressing them. But by thinking about the happiness of Krishna, of whom I am a part. And then naturally I get all my desires fulfilled. Up to the level of the residents of Vrindavan, who not only forget about their own happiness, they forget about themselves. You know, we experience this to some extent in this world. If we're so focused on a goal or a mission, we're experiencing such happiness from the goal that we're working for, the mission, the cause, or the person we're working for, that we don't stop to think, am I happy? We're overflowing with happiness from what we're doing. And we often don't stop to think about ourselves at all. We're just focused on our goal. So we have a little idea of this. So the devotees are so focused on Krishna that and they're overflowing with joy and freedom. Why do they need to think about their joy and their freedom? It's not necessary. You know, if you have somebody, if you're living at the home of a rich person who's providing you with ample food every day, you don't need to think about, am I going to eat? You can forget about it. They say that among different classes of people, they ask different questions about food. Did you know that? If you go to a meal at a poor person's house, they'll say, did you get enough? And if you go to the meal at a middle-class person's house, they'll say, did you like it? And if you go to the meal at a rich person's house, they'll say, did you like the presentation? Because, of course, you're going to get enough and it's going to taste good. It's not even a question. So as soon as we just care about Krishna, everything we want is fulfilled so many millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of times. There's no need to think about it separately. And we achieve this by falling in love with Krishna. Why try to get these things? We're getting them from Krishna anyway. They're coming from Krishna anyway. And really, they're part of our own nature already. We really already have these things. It's not really something to achieve. Rupa Goswami says in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, it's not exactly that practice achieves bhakti, like you practice to play the violin, you know, and you become an expert violinist. It's already there. Bhakti's already there. It's already our nature. We already have. Yad bhava bhavita diyo manudastataiva samprapya rupa mahima sanayana bhusha suktayame vanigama pratitais duvanti govindamari purusham tamaham bhajami. We already have our home, our jewels, our sitting places, everything. We already have. It's already there. The only thing we need to do is reestablish our loving and service relationship with Krishna. That's all. And one thing. And everything else that we want is achieved because everything else is already there. We already have everything. We're just, you know, it's already there. It's just there. And we're looking for it over here. So therefore, someone like Narada who sees a highly elevated person like Prachinna Barishat, who's in the family of Dhruva Maharaj, where all of the persons in the families are great devotees. He thinks this person has the potential to find the truth, the word tattva, to find the truth. So he goes to help him. And of course, King Prachinabharisha does achieve the truth. There is a member of this family who does not achieve the truth. Narada also tries to help him, but doesn't get anywhere. Do you know who that is? Yes, Daksha. Yes, these Prachetas, when they come out of the water and they all become the joint husband of Marisha, they give birth to Daksha in his second incarnation. And he's an interesting person because he sees Lord Vishnu. He actually feels some bhava when he sees Lord Vishnu. But still, he's attached to this fruit of mentality. He's interested in what he's going to get from the Lord rather than in his relationship with the Lord. So anyway, this is the truth. What Narada is giving is the truth. That all these things we want, which boil down to two things, karma and gyan, we want them because they're already part of us. They're already our nature. And in fact, when we have a relationship with Krishna, they become very insignificant. And if you really want them in the proper way, even if that's your initial motive, which basically for 99% of people, it will be the initial motive, you get them by having a direct relationship of love with Krishna. Just fall in love with Krishna. Do some service for Krishna. Do some service for Krishna's devotees. And then whatever you could possibly want through any other way will be achieved. Now, in comparison to our natural position of spiritual, unlimited, eternal opulence, these other things have no meaning. Having some little reflection for a flash of time, when we have eternal, genuine, real, truthful opulences, who would care for that? If you have millions and millions and millions and millions, an unlimited room full of gold bars, what is the use of monopoly money? You know, why even consider it? So therefore, Narada is urging us to seek the truth. So I was good and stayed in the time limit. Now we have 3 minutes for questions. Questions, comments, additions, subtractions, corrections, chastisements. Yes? It seems like that, because the Ishupanishad says that ignorance is bad and false knowledge is worse. And then it says temporary things are bad and false eternal is worse, basically, if you look at the Sanskrit. So the way I understand that is wolves are bad and wolves that look like sheep are worse. Sure. Okay, but that's... Then go next verse.
Why should it explain that one result is derived from the culture of
knowledge? No, not that one. Next one after that, sorry.
Only one who can learn the process of the messages and
that... I'm still not getting the right one. There's two. Can somebody help me?
Those who engage in the worship of the demigods...
Yeah, there we go. There we go.
...ignorance, and still more so through the worship of the impersonal...
There you go. That's it. That's it. Yeah, there's three and three. Three on knowledge and ignorance and three on demigods and Brahman. Because this is talking about demigods and Brahman, going to the heavenly planets or going into the Brahman. So here in this verse of Ishopanishad, but if you look at the Sanskrit for that verse, the worshippers of the demigods and the worshippers of the so-called absolute. Sambhutam. Prabhupada's translating Sambhutam as the worshippers of the demigods or the worshippers of the false absolute. But that's very, it's a very interesting place where it's reversed. And it's as far as I know, it's the only place where it's described in a reverse way, that it's better to be a materialist than a false spiritualist. Yeah, the first is talking about knowledge and ignorance, and the second is talking about matter and spirit. Is a series of three and three. There's a number of... Have you ever had Radhika Raman come and teach anything here? He was teaching. Actually, yeah, it was here. It was for that summer seminar that you guys don't do anymore. He was teaching about Jiva Goswami, and he was giving the six main categories of verses that describe a shastra. And we were all doing some practical application. We did it with Ishopanishad. And one of the categories is something surprising, something unusual, and that's what we picked. That Ishopanishad, you know, knowledge, false knowledge is worse than ignorance, and false absolute is worse than the demigods. But anyway, generally speaking, a desire for freedom and peacefulness and fearlessness is considered much higher than a desire for pleasure. I mean, Krishna says you can't get any happiness without peace. So a desire for happiness mixed with anxiety is much lower than a desire for the happiness that comes from peace and fearlessness. Okay, anything else? Yes, Prabhu. Yes. He said we're never interested in the goal. A devotee does not give any importance to the ultimate goal of the Karmis and the Gyanis. So we hear about kings like Janak and Prithu who perform fruitive activities. That's another class. But just briefly, Krishna says the self-realized souls have no reason to perform ordinary fruitive activities, nor do they have any reason to give them up. And yadyadatarati shrestas. They generally do that to set an example for human society. And it's, see if I can do this in 1 minute or less. I was listening today to the beginning of where Krishna is talking to Nanda Maharaj about performing the Govardhan Puja. And Krishna's talking about you have to act according to your natural instinct, which is, of course, one of Krishna's main points in the Bhagavad Gita. You have to do for Krishna according to your natural inclination. And there it's Prabhupada's translating as your natural instinct. And Krishna says anyone who does not act according to their natural instinct is like an unchaste woman. So many times, as I say, this is a whole other class, this is another 2-hour discussion, but many times devotees think surrender to Krishna means that I deny my natural instincts, I deny my natural proclivities, and I do somebody else's duty, which is, of course, that's what Arjuna thought, so it's not very surprising that members of ISKCON think this way, since Arjuna had the same problem, and he kept bringing up this question over and over again throughout the Bhagavad Gita. So. But Krishna made it very clear in the 3rd chapter and the 18th chapter, you have to do, you're going to act by your natural instinct anyway. There's no question of repressing it. Surrender doesn't mean to pretend to be something you're not. Surrender means to take what you are and use that for Krishna. So that's the situation of everyone below the platform of Brahmabhuta. We have two who we are's. We have our real who we are, and then we have our temporary false who we are. Okay. So if, as long as you're identifying with the temporary false who you are, you have to use that for Krishna or you'll use it for Maya. There's no question of not using it. That's not possible. You can't maintain that. So those who are above Brahmabhuta, who no longer have a false who I am, still, they often act apparently according to that false designation, either because Krishna has some business for them or to set an example. Because otherwise people who are still in the false identity will think that renunciation is the means rather than the symptom of the goal. And I'll give you a very, very simple example and then I should end. And that, like, I'm designing a program to teach children how to read. So when you already know how to read, you actually read several words at a time. You don't read individual words and you don't sound them out. You read them by sight. In fact, you can sight read words as long as they have the first letter and the last letter the same as the actual word and all the letters of the real word. If the internal letters are switched, you can still read the word. It's quite interesting. So that's the behavior of an accomplished reader. And we're also predicting what the story is going to be about. We're predicting according to grammar. We're predicting according to content. We're predicting according to the format of an essay or a narrative or whatever. That's the behavior of an expert reader. So there were some educationalists who thought, all right, why are we teaching children to read, you know, the is this? We should just teach them to read. This means that a devotee. Why don't we just have them read like an expert reader in the beginning? Yeah, exactly. What happened? It was a disaster. You know, a few children learned how to read because they were just so smart, they figured it out anyway, but most of the poor kids didn't learn how to read. So at the beginning stage, it's necessary. You know, but we don't read like that. And if you're teaching a beginning reader, guess what you do? You act like you're a beginning reader too. You have to. You're modeling what you want them to do. If you model the behavior of an expert, they'll never be able to read. So it's necessary. Otherwise, people think, oh, the way to become advanced is to imitate the symptoms of already being advanced. So that's true for some things. Like advanced devotees naturally chant Hare Krishna, and we also chant Hare Krishna. But the expert devotees, they know how to model what the beginners need to do. And if they don't do that, there'll be chaos in society. So that's their service. They're not interested in the ultimate goal of the karmis. They're doing those activities as their service for Krishna. Okay, I need to end now. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.